Welcome to the GAC Files, a podcast about the people, issues, and ideas driving Global Affairs Canada.
Bienvenue dans les dossiers d'AMC, un balado sur les personnes, les défis et les idées qui animent Affaires mondiales Canada.
And now, introducing your host, Global Affairs Canada's David Morrison.
Et maintenant, présentant votre hôte, David Morrison d'Affaires mondiales Canada.
Shauna Hemingway has gone from farm girl in rural Ontario to Canada's ambassador in the Dominican Republic in remarkably short order. Along the way, she spent some years working in journalism, including for the police services in the UK. When we recently chatted about her life and her current posting as a first-time ambassador, Shauna offered up some real wisdom on the importance of passion, the importance of curiosity, and the importance of learning to listen. Hey, Shauna, thanks for coming by today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We first met, I think, in Mexico some years ago when you were doing trade work. After that, you did a turn on the G7 with Peter Beam, I think.
That's right.
And now you're our relatively recently minted HOM in Santo Domingo. So we want to hear all about that, but want to, as we have been doing on the GAC Files, start at the beginning and where you're from and how you got to where you are. On peut le faire, bien sûr, en anglais ou en français. Podríamos hacerlo en español también, pero a lo mejor eso necesitaría un poco de traducción. So let's get it going by just, why don't you tell me how it all began?
Parfait, merci pour l'invitation. Hago muchas entrevistas en español, pero vamos a hacer más en las lenguas oficiales de Canadá hoy. So I grew up in a very small town, and not even in the town. I grew up on a farm near Lake Huron, and spent those early years with really no idea what I wanted to do. I didn't know what the options were. And in fact, a real turning point in my life was when I turned to my parents in university and said, what am I going to do with this political science degree or history degree? And they were like, I have no idea. We never studied, you know, we never went to university.
Right,
we studied
right.
the trades. And so for me, that was a big turning point where I realized I needed to take control
right.
of my own career, and there wasn't anybody who was going to be able to advise me on that. So I went off to university and sought out opportunities, really just following the doors as they opened, and that led me to join the varsity volleyball team, and then I left that to work pretty much full-time hours at the Toronto Star while I was also studying at the University of Toronto.
And from there, I don't know when, but quite soon after you graduated, I think you ended up in the UK.
That's right. Yeah. So I finished at the last year of U of T. I headed off to another opportunity that just sort of fell into my lap at university. Went to the UK and started looking for work there. And drawing on my crime reporting experience at the Toronto Star, I moved to police communications with the British Police Force, which was...
Yeah, I remember when I first saw your CV when you were in the running to become a HOM in Latin America, because presumably because you already spoke Spanish, and I thought, there's not a lot of foreign service officers that spent, I don't know, it was a decade or 5 years or something, working for the police service in the UK. So tell us about that.
It was really eye-opening, I have to say. Both the Toronto Star experience and working for the police really prepared.
What started you in journalism?
Well, that's interesting. I got into it. There was a very attractive young man who was editing the University of Toronto newspaper, and I thought, well, that
you
would
don't
be
need
good.
To give his name. But.
No, I'm not sure I can remember his name. But so I sort of followed that. Did quite a bit of writing for the university paper, and then again, just by total fluke, someone didn't show up for their interview because their roommate didn't give them the message, and so the Toronto Star had a last-minute opening that summer. I was months past the deadline to apply, and they just happened to pull my CV, and then I ended up at the Toronto Star, which was a great experience, and I think most importantly, it taught me to... I had to do up to 8 articles in a single shift, so an 8-hour shift.
Wow.
It taught me to... to let go of all the hang-ups you have in terms of getting your material out there fast. And when I hear the minister speak now about timeliness over perfection, I get that, because certainly that killed the perfectionist in me.
Journalists understand deadlines.
That's right.
Bureaucrats, sometimes not so much, but... That would have been, was that in pre-web publication days?
Absolutely. Right. I think I got my first email address while I was working at the Toronto Star. So.
But back in those days, the paper went to bed. And if you missed deadline, you lost your job. I mean, you know, if you were chronically missing deadlines, you lost your job.
That's so it. You couldn't. You absolutely couldn't. Right. Yeah.
You also, as a journalist, and this is relevant for our current line of business, if you're given 850 words, you bring it in at 850 words. So like a one pager is a one pager, not a page and three quarters, right?
Absolutely.
Or you're doing your editor a huge disservice.
No, that's right. And I actually take quite a bit of pride in government work, because I find I have a lot more time to write these things than I did as a journalist. And if they're asking for 500 words, I deliver 500 words or 499. I enjoy getting, even though nobody notices, I enjoy getting that.
Well, people do notice, because there is, from where I sit and where anybody that has to review the written product sits, something that is well written and concise is gold. So I think with so much cutting and pasting, I think we can forget that. But anyhow, this is all sort of wonky. Let's get back to your life as a police communications official in the UK.
Yeah, and that as well I find really relevant now. I did a lot of television and radio back then, and I think in the British media, I don't think you can find media as difficult as the British media. And so you have satellite trucks camped out on your doorstep. I have police officers who are calling me in the night because they've got media camping out on, you know, again, in front of their house, and just a lot of problem shooting.
So you were on the front lines. Explain the role of a police spokesperson. A crime happens, and journalists call you, or how does it work?
Yeah, immediately. I think often we have a great system there where I could go right in and see, like, up to the minute what the police officers were putting about a certain incident, which I think is a disadvantage that we don't have as consular officials abroad. We don't have the same access into the police input, but you can pull that out. You hate to hear about something for the first time from a journalist. You like to like to know it's coming up. But and being, I think the hardest is being out in front of the bank of media. And in that line of work at that time, we had to make a lot of decisions in terms of releasing people's names. And all that was taken by the communications people, which, again, was a heady responsibility.
How did you – I'm fascinated by this. I've lived in the UK as well. How did you integrate into such an overwhelmingly British institution as a Canadian?
Absolutely. I think, again, following an open door. So building on the fact that I had done crime reporting for the Toronto Star, which is a recognizable – newspaper, even in the UK. And I built on that and sought out any opportunity I could. I was a new graduate at that time, and it seemed to me that was what I was best prepared to do. And an opening came up, and I grabbed it.
But did you, once you were there, how well accepted were you? You were the spokesperson for this quintessentially British institution. Did you put on a fake British accent, or how did you actually pull it off?
Yeah, I'm sure I had a mid-Atlantic accent at some point, but what I did, I had to adjust to their vocabulary. So lorries, when we're talking about, you know, you had to be something that made sense to the public.
Put the body in the boot.
Exactly. No, exactly. That's it. They did have a few bodies in boots.
Right. So without going all grisly on us, tell us, what did you learn? What were the biggest challenges, and what did you learn that you have fallen back on in the subsequent career as a Foreign Service officer?
I think, well, it led to me seeking out a position to work for my own government, because I was working for, of course, the Home Office at that time, and I thought, why not apply my skills to working for my own government, my own people, the Canadian people. So that was part of it. But I think we had some rather difficult colleagues. We had a lot of challenging files. We had colleagues that definitely had complex personal lives as well. And being the media spokesperson, I tended to be on the front line when some of those problems became public.
About the police service.
Exactly, right. Exactly. Right. There were friends and colleagues who committed suicide. We had one who very tragically killed his family, children, and his wife, which is very difficult. And dealing with his family as they tried to come to terms with what their own son had done was quite difficult. Also, some of the great successes we had. One of the first cases I had the opportunity to publicize was when they convicted someone of sex crimes abroad. Mm. It was in Thailand, but they convicted him in the UK. Right. And that was one of the first examples of that in the world. And it was a great opportunity to really celebrate getting something done for the public good.
Was the person was back in the UK then? Wasn't convicted exactly. In absentia?
No, they were back in the UK and they had been picked up there. But again, I dealt with his wife, who was just entirely traumatized by what she was seeing too.
Wow. Puis, après tout ça, comment t'as trouvé dans le service extérieur du Canada?
Oui, j'ai connu une femme qui travaillait pour le FCO dans ce cas-là. Donc, j'ai parlé avec elle beaucoup de temps. Ça m'a paru très intéressant son travail comme diplomate. Donc, j'ai cherché aussi l'opportunité. Et 2 mois après, j'ai vu les examens en Internet et j'ai... Ouais.
Et tu as créé l'examen à Londres?
À Londres, ou? Ouais. Oui, à Londres. Okay. Et après, j'ai eu des interviews à Paris.
OK. Donc, Et c'était quand?
Ah, il y a 2002.
2002,
oui, il y a beaucoup de
Puis, tu étais accepté et...
Ça a pris beaucoup de temps.
Oui, OK. Combien? Quelques années ou...
Oui, une année complète. Je crois que maintenant, ça peut être un peu plus long, mais dans ce cas-là... Après une année, j'ai reçu l'offre.
Ah, OK.
Et je crois 3 mois après, j'étais ici.
Quand, dans ma cas personnel, c'était 2 ans, parce qu'en une année pour tous les processus, et après une année pour la vérification de sécurité. So maybe we're getting a little faster, but it still seems to be induction or recruitment seems a long... process. Anyhow, did you know Ottawa when you arrived?
No, not at all. I had never lived here. I'd visited, of course, like a lot of Canadians, but I didn't know a single person in Ottawa. So I had no connections in government, and it's something that as an ambassador now that I tend to emphasize a lot in the Dominican Republic, where they don't have a professionalized system for recruiting, and I think it's a real advantage. We have such a diverse foreign service as a result, and we talk a lot about... you know, cultural diversity and all the rest, but also, you know, between having representatives from the city or representatives from, you know, farming communities.
Farms in Ontario, yeah.
Exactly. I think that really enriches our service here in Canada.
So you mentioned just before we went on the air that you appreciated just how transparent the process was because you didn't grow up with your sights on... job in the Canadian Foreign Service. You stumbled across this while you were in the UK using the internet and, you know, through luck and talent and so on were accepted and then you've started. We just very recently as a executive team spent a day up at Meech Lake earlier this week actually talking about human resources issues. And one of the things that the senior-most people in the department seem to feel quite strongly about is the necessity of recruiting people from across Canada and from very diverse backgrounds. And, you know, I had never been to Ottawa until I joined the Foreign Service. So I think there was a fairly strong sense amongst senior managers that we owed it to the future of the Foreign Service to ensure that the tradition that this place has had from the get-go of bringing people in from all across Canada is maintained. In any event, what did you talk to us a little bit about where you started and how you got to Santo Domingo from there?
Yeah, I think, like you say, that's so important, not just I gained a lot coming in through the regular recruitment process from getting to know people from across Canada. So I joined with people from Newfoundland, from Alberta, from BC, and from totally different studies. One had done his PhD in medieval studies. And I think, isn't that great that we have a foreign service where people can apply with really diverse backgrounds? I just, throughout my career, followed things that piqued my interest. Yeah. And I think that that resulted in a fairly diverse person at the end of the process. And for instance, just to give you an example, in the DR today in Dominican Republic, there's a Canadian mining company that has a great interest, a stake in a real agricultural part of the DR, and it happens to be where the president is from. And the fact that, you know, I came from a farm and I understand the value of agriculture, I'm able to really transmit Canada's focus and sincerity when we talk about not letting Canadian industry in any way impede on, you know, agricultural production in a farming community. So I think I also played varsity volleyball. Volleyball is huge in the DR. As a young girl, I was in love with the Blue Jays, and one Blue Jay in particular, who is Tony Fernandez, and he's a great baseball player. Right. But again, that all these little things that are particular to your personality.
It also becomes the fabric of the relationships that are how diplomacy actually works.
That's true.
We met in Mexico, but before that, was Mexico your first posting?
It was my second posting. So I'd been posted to Korea, South Korea, and also credited to North Korea, which was a fascinating experience.
Did you visit?
I did four times. Was quite a eye-opening experience that, again, applicable to other...
When was that?
I was there in, I want to get the dates right, 2006 to 2009, so four visits in those years.
I lived there at the end of the 80s, so
I remember
we can talk more, we can share Pyongyang experiences offline, but agreed, fascinating place, and of course very topical right now. So Korea, Mexico, where you were you were in the trade section.
Yeah, it was the economic section. So I headed the economic section, which kind of bridges that political political and trade links, but worked very closely with the heads of both those other programs, and a great experience. I think it's interesting. Graham Clark, when I was going out as a head of mission, I asked what he thought was important, and he said, you just need to fall in love with the country you're accredited to. That's your job as an ambassador, is to fall in love. And I had never looked at it from that perspective, but I think that's true across my postings. You know, I still love Korean food. Mexico will always be close to my heart. Right. I have now a Mexican family, and also in DR. But from Mexico, I came back and did G7, G20, and I had done trade commissioner work here in Ottawa, plus then trade policy work for a few years, working on trade agreements, and then the more political work abroad. And I think that coming back to the G7, I was able to sort of use all that policy experience, and it was a good opportunity.
So I wasn't aware of Graham's phrase, but it's a lovely phrase, and I think that kind of speaks to the passion that many of us hold for the places we're sent. Just as an aside, I personally returned yesterday from a fascinating 24 hours in Mexico with Minister Freeland and Minister Morneau and Minister Carr, getting to know the new Mexican government. They've just had a historic election, and what a fascinating place, and it's set for a fascinating 6 years to come. But back to your career, what I find interesting is, I don't know, are you a trade commissioner, are you a political person, you've done some comms, you've done multilateral, with at least in the G7 sense of that, and I strongly believe that that kind of trajectory where you've shown you can walk and chew gum is actually the ideal preparation for becoming a HOM, where of course you're responsible for all of those things. Did you choose those assignments deliberately, or did you just say, well, trade policy, that sounds interesting?
Yeah, not at all deliberate. I'd say I think what's governed me, at least for my professional career, has been just looking where can I learn something, what door is open, what looks interesting, and just following my interests. I think when I was in university and I talked about how I had this crisis in second year where I realized my political science degree wasn't really going to get me where I wanted, or so I thought then, I thought I needed to study a certain career and follow that particular path. And I think I learned afterwards, and I certainly feel I know now, and it's what the advice I give to students when I speak to them in Dominican Republic. But it really is all about just following something that you're passionate about. So even if it's just for a short period of time, if you have a strong interest and sort of throw your all into it, you develop all sorts of skills that you can't predict that you'll... Mm. I had no idea some of the experiences that are relevant to consular and natural disasters that I would pick up from my time in the police work that are now relevant as a head of mission. So I really could not have predicted where my time went. If I had stayed and excelled as a varsity volleyball player, I probably wouldn't be here today. I would have had a different life.
Maybe coaching in the Dominican Republic.
That's right.
Let's
I may have ended up in the Dominican Republic. Yeah.
Let's talk about your life as a HOM. This was a pretty big leadership step for you, I think. Mm-hmm. You can tell us how large the mission is, but you have a big job, you have a young family, you have been, I think, in the spotlight a little bit. There's a couple of complex consular cases I'm aware of. You do have there are significant Canadian commercial interests there. How are you? Mm-hmm. What have you learned about yourself? How are you managing it all?
Yeah, I think I think anytime you start a new job, there's a real learning curve. But I think more so than ever when you start as a head of mission, because suddenly the array of responsibilities is enormous.
Mm. Bigger than you had anticipated?
In a way, I think broader. And I think too, the degree to which you still need to delve down into the details. Even as a HOM, you still need to know have a good sense of all the files. I think that it's a lot to learn all at once. And also, looking at the policies and the way an embassy works, I saw your discussion with Patricia Pena, and I don't envy her going on a first posting as a head of mission. I think her and I stay in touch, and it's a totally different experience. But I think it's been an opportunity to use skills that had gone a bit dormant, I guess. When you're in Ottawa, we have such a broad workforce here that you really do specialize quite a bit in whether it's you do a lot of writing. And now I'm the person sitting with the president, right? Having those discussions one-on-one with the head of state. Whereas before, I'd previously really only been the person
writing
in the background.
Writing the note.
Exactly. Yeah. And it requires a whole different skill set. I have a lot of respect, especially for our politicians.
Right.
We get a lot of media
requests.
Well,
you have to be on all the time.
That's right.
And if you make a mistake, everybody knows about it instantly.
That's true.
It's a different level of pressure, it seems, as well as needing always to be sort of mentally agile, no matter how tired you are.
Get sick. There's days where you absolutely can't be sick. It just can't happen.
Et du point de vue travail, famille, qu'est-ce que tu penses?
Oui, ça c'est quelque chose de nouveau un peu pour moi aussi. J'ai une jeune famille et je crois que ce qui importe plus que l'autre chose est de prioriser tout ce que je fais. Il faut choisir les priorités et aussi prendre des décisions des fois très difficiles. Donc, l'important pour moi, c'est de, avec ma famille, choisir bien les moments que je veux passer avec les enfants. Donc, tous les jours, je mène mes enfants à l'école. Et ça, c'est un temps très important pour moi et pour la famille.
Mm. Yeah. Yep. It's all those things are really about how we set priorities. Mm-hmm. Tell me, you were interested in talking a little bit about being an ambassador in the era of social media. You were started your communications career before the internet. So tell us your experience with social media and how you think that's changed the practice of diplomacy.
I think it's a great opportunity, but there are also great challenges. So, for instance, you reach this broad audience, and something that the Prime Minister, when he first took office, mentioned to his heads of missions was this expectation that they would get out of the capital cities and that they would engage with regular people. And it's something that, particularly in a society like in the Dominican Republic, that I get commented on a lot is my engagement with regular people and how I'm, you know, breaking norms as an ambassador and getting out into the field, which I really feel is what we all should have been doing. But it's much more obvious. I can set priorities and themes that I'm focusing on by determining what I put on my social media. I think the challenge, too, though, is it's a very imperfect picture. I spend an awful lot of my time troubleshooting for Canadian companies. It's really important for Canada, but a big part of the job there. And that doesn't get picked up because those are the things you don't tend to put on your social media. So it is an imperfect picture. I think challenging, too. I'm grateful every day that I had the communications background that I had, not knowing how it would serve me now, but I can, I think, fairly consistently identify what is safe ground and where we shouldn't go, because at the same time, you're speaking to Dominicans, but you're also speaking to Canadians simultaneously.
Sure.
And that can be very difficult because you don't choose your audience with social media.
What have you learned about yourself? You've been there a year. You'll be there another 1 or 2 years, I think. I hope I'm not telling you anything you don't know.
I hope I'll be there another 2 years.
Okay, let's say 2 years. But what you're a third of the way through, say, what have you learned? And on a personal sense, what do you hope to continue working on over the length of your first job as a head of mission?
I think the value and the great advantage of being focused on the person you're speaking to at any given time. I think that's something that anyone who's
I got distracted there for a second.
That's it. Sort of in the political eye, again, it's something that some of the great politicians are able to do. And that's really one person that I identified recently was Michaëlle Jean. I find with her, it doesn't matter if she's talking to a head of state or she's talking with a girl from an orphanage who's HIV positive, and the same amount of attention, the same amount of caring, and also the importance of putting people at the center of everything you do. And I think across the board, if you try and think about the people that your decision affects, so if it's the staff in the embassy, or it's the farming community where a Canadian company is setting up shop, or whether it's Canadian consular client who's just lost their passport, and for them, it's a very major event in their life. For us, it's a pretty daily occurrence. But just focusing on them, I think you can't go wrong. And that's something that I think I've learned over the last year.
What a great lesson, and what a great piece of wisdom to wind down on. This has been terrific. I in particular, the notion of fall in love with your country, I think those are words to live by in our business. Be curious. We all in our positions, or many of us, get asked all of the time by young people, how did you end up where you are today? And in most cases, it's not because of a master plan, it's because of passion and curiosity. You mentioned mentorship with Patricia Pena, or at least mentorship or colleagueship, learning from each other, and then person to person, being in the moment, actually listening to people. Those are all great lessons from Shauna Hemingway, our hom in Santo Domingo. Alors, merci beaucoup pour être venu aujourd'hui.
Merci beaucoup pour l'invitation.
Okay.
We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. If you have feedback or suggestions for future topics or guest speakers, please send David an email.
Nous espérons que vous avez apprécié la discussion d'aujourd'hui. Si vous avez des commentaires ou des suggestions concernant de sujets futurs ou de nouveaux conférenciers, veuillez envoyer un courriel à David.
Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us on the next episode of The GAC Files.
Merci d'avoir écouté le balado, et nous espérons que vous vous joindrez à nous pour le prochain épisode des Dossiers d'AMC.